In this week's episode, we tease out the many reasons for cesarean birth versus vaginal birth. Some reasons warranted and some the cause of an impatient modern medical system. We walk you through how to prepare for a C-section if you know you're going to have one. We also give you some tips for the quick moments before a potentially unplanned cesarean. Dr. Leah shares her unique perspective on her home birth turned cesarean and how a frame shift in her mindset helped her find moments of peace in the OR. We discuss our top tips for thorough healing and recovery and give many practical remedies, therapies, and resources sprinkled throughout the episode. We hope you find value here, whether it's in your preparation or for your emotional and physical healing afterwards. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes. Today, we are talking all about C-sections, which is short for cesarean section, and birth in general is just Dr. Morgan's, you know, wheelhouse, and she knows so much about that transition of bringing your baby into the world. And I had a C-section, so we both bring different expertise to this topic, and so, you know, we're going to kind of popcorn back and forth chatting about this because there's a lot to unpack when it comes to C-sections and how to do it maybe a little bit more optimally and just the support that maybe you're not getting or that you could get more of. So let's just hop right in and chat first about the reasons for C-sections. Dr. Morgan, take it away.
Yeah. So we've been getting questions about this from the followers on Instagram for a long time. And so we decided to finally prioritize a whole episode around it. And it's, you know, nice that you have the experience too, because you actually have a very unique experience of a C-section. A lot of people end up usually, depending on how the whole rest of the birth went, but can have feelings of disappointment. And I know you have those feelings too, but I think that there's a way that you've sort of frame shifted it in your mind that is really empowering for people who've had to go through this, and that it doesn't have to be this super duper negative thing the whole time. And so we'll talk about that at one point too. But then I wanted to talk about all of the options and ways that things can be supported with naturopathic medicine, because that's our wheelhouse, is, you know, the symptoms and what are the reasons for C-section and how can we maybe change things and what things to ask your provider depending on if there is time, if it's a planned cesarean or not. And yeah, so we're just going to kind of go in. So about, I mean, let's just dive in. So the reasons for cesarean. So there's definitely legitimate reasons why cesareans are necessary. There are definitely people who think nobody ever needs a cesarean, and that's just not true. Like we are super, super blessed to have this technology. Many women died in the process of, you know, trying to figure out medically how to do the cesareans properly and how to, you know, and then many more died prior to that because there was maybe preventable issues going on. And so throughout the history of birth, I mean, it's actually quite dark looking into the history of birth because of the way that we've managed things. And then when we had some medical knowledge and then we didn't have enough medical knowledge, and so we weren't doing things like washing our hands, a lot of women died from that. Because this is actually like really interesting little tidbit in history, is that there was a time period once where the OBGYNs, which were only allowed to be able to be male, had really high death rates of their postpartum women. And the midwives did not. The midwives could only be women. The OBGYNs were the ones that were going around all parts of the hospitals, including the morgue. And they did not know about germ theory. They did not know about germs, illnesses, bacteria, viruses at that point. And they were not washing their hands at all. So they were introducing, you know, necrotizing bacteria and things to pregnant or, you know, postpartum women or throughout the delivery. And the midwives were not, because they didn't have the rights or the option or ability to go into those other parts of the hospital. And so if a woman was, you know, a baby had been delivered by the midwife, she seemed to live much better, and they couldn't figure it out for a very long time. I just find that to be so fascinating, because to us nowadays, it seems like so duh, but there's been a lot of technological advances, and we're very grateful for C-sections. And also another double-edged sword to this with all technology and advancement, in my opinion, is that things can get kind of out of hand. And right now in this country, we have a 36% C-section rate for the first time mom. And that's too much. Like, yeah. I mean, even just in the 80s and 90s, it was 10%, you know, and depending on the type of, you know, what state and what hospital, et cetera, of course, but like on average, it was way, 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 way less.
Right. It's like there are things that women would have died in childbirth, even before the medical intervention killing them necessarily. But there were things that probably happened naturally. I mean, we know there were, where women died that a C-section probably could have saved them and their child. But that percentage back then and now is so much lower than 30%. It's not that 30% of births require that. And so that's what we're saying. It's like there is a time and a place for C-sections. Yes, women used to die in these like really rare and tricky situations potentially. And 30% of women delivering maybe don't need that intervention. And there are risks to the intervention as well. So it's not without its harm. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think a lot of people think too, erroneously, that, oh, getting a C-section is like the safe, easy way out. And it's like, whoa, we need to actually really remember that this is a very risky procedure. And there is a lot of complication that can happen from cesarean and a lot of risk. And absolutely the lowest risk route out for a baby, unless it has some kind of an extenuating circumstance, would be a vaginal birth for the mother and the baby. So, I mean, I think the things have just gotten a little bit twisted in our minds and we kind of think, oh, more technology, more modernity, better. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I don't know. It comes with some risks and problems as well. So anyways, I just wanted to talk about some of the reasons why somebody might need a cesarean or want a cesarean. That are, you know, a medical indication, et cetera. And then we'll talk about some of the reasons that are happening today and probably often unnecessarily. So to start with the legitimate ones here, there's a lot of placental or cord anomalies or issues that can take place that would give very good reasoning, something like a placenta previa. So that means that the placenta has attached close to the opening of the cervix at the bottom of the uterus. And that even despite out all of the growth of the uterus along the pregnancy, the placenta did not move enough to make a very clear open path for that cervix to open and dilate safely. Mm-hmm. And so if the placenta is in the way, imagine if something is attached to a hole that's going to open, that hole, your placenta is going to bleed and you're going to bleed out and the baby would probably die. You would probably die. It would not be a very... it's not a scenario where you can really risk it.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious that this is happening in case, you know, you're in a situation where you never had an ultrasound or whatever it is. There would just be like a lot of bleeding at the beginning of labor as soon as your cervix starts to dilate. So you would need to go and get some attention. There's also placenta accreta, which is where the placenta actually like attaches into the muscle wall of the uterus in a different kind of a way. It's not as much of the superficial attachment that a normal placenta has. It's really buried deep and it's not going to unattach properly. And the worry here is that, again, more about postpartum bleeding and just bleeding in general. And it is best to manage that with a cesarean as well. Now, one thing to know about note about placenta accreta is that it is more likely to have placenta accreta in a woman who has had a prior cesarean. So that is the highest risk category of placenta accreta is women who have had a history of a cesarean.
Now, do you know about a placenta accreta before you give birth? Or is that something that you only find out about at delivery?
It would be something that you would find out on an ultrasound for sure.
Someone would know going into it.
Yes. If they decided to not get ultrasounds, then maybe they would not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's always the pros and cons of that. Into this question, because we get asked this all the time, I am very pro anatomy scan. I'm very pro getting a quick anatomy scan. I'm not pro like an hour and a half long anatomy scan. And I've definitely heard of that happening. I don't think it needs to be that long. I think that we can talk with our provider or maybe find somebody who's willing to just go a little quicker and not hang out and spend a ton of time there. Because yes, there's this potential risk that we're kind of toggling with ultrasound. At that point, though, at a 20-week fetus is really different than maybe getting multiple multiple ultrasounds in the first trimester when the cells being vibrated could be a potentially much more damaging thing. Although, right. I mean, again, I think there's pros and cons, and I don't know, we talk about this at some episode, but I can talk more about that later if you guys want, just let us know. Anyways, then there's like some, you know, placental shapes that, or the way that the Wharton's jelly, which is that white stuff that makes the umbilical cord white. Wharton's jelly is really cool. We got to play with it in lab. And then of course I've been at several births and had my own babies, so it can feel it. And you have as well, but it, like, it's impossible to tie an umbilical cord in a knot that will like hold or keep or stay tight. It just slips out because this material protectively for the baby and in line with life is made out of this very, very jelly thick kind of almost silicone. It would be like trying to tie a silicone straw. Like you just, it's like hard. And yeah. Make that silicone straw covered in like jellyfish material.
Right.
So, but if there is something where part of the vessels that are inside of the cord are not covered in Wharton's jelly, they're exposed, or maybe there's a multi-lobe placenta. So instead of just being one big round kind of patty, it's like two pieces. That can be something called like a velamentous cord, a velamentous insertion. There's different other words that are not important for you guys to know, but there are things that can happen with your placenta. Again, this would be found on ultrasound. So this is why I think that these are important. Honestly, in my opinion, the most important part of the anatomy scan ultrasound is to look at the placenta, not even really looking at the baby as much. Mm-hmm. Because this is where we can find out some of these anomalies that really have no other symptoms otherwise. So that's my two cents about that. And then if there's something like a placental abruption, which would be like usually from an accident or an impact, it could be just something that randomly happens, but it's super duper rare for that to happen. But it would basically be that like during the labor or even before labor has started, the placenta starts to come away from the wall of the uterus. Mm-hmm. And so again, you would have bleeding. Unless you're not dilated at all, then you may not have bleeding, but you would probably have pain and weird symptoms. And then you'd start to have vitals change because you'd be losing a lot of blood internally. So this is a reason for an emergency cesarean. And then another one, cord prolapse, which I think everyone should know about. And I don't really know why they don't talk about it routinely in most childbirth classes, but it's rare too. So, I mean, yeah, a lot of these things are very rare. We don't need everyone to know about them, but a cord prolapse would be in the situation where your water breaks kind of abruptly, fully, completely, a big, lots of water. Maybe the baby was floating up very high. You could be in labor or not for this to occur. But the whole thing is just that some of the cord comes out through the cervix before the baby is, and before it's supposed to. And the problem with that is that now there's not a floating water bag for the baby to kind of stay upright and, you know, ambiently floating around in there. And now all the water's gone. There's a loop of cord hanging out and baby's head is going to be pressing on it and occluding it and cutting off blood supply and oxygen.
Right.
Whatever happens. And sometimes what's tricky is that the cord prolapse can actually just be a tiny bit and it's actually still inside of the vagina. So you won't be able to tell that it's happening. Right. If it's hanging down between your legs, obviously that's very like clear and obvious. It would be a loop because it's still attached to baby on one end and placenta on the other end. If this ever happens, just so you know what to do, or if you're ever out in public, this happens to somebody, or I don't know, whatever. Just, I think that these things are good to know because you could save a life.
Totally.
Exactly. Is get her down on hands and knees, like child's pose, like butt up in the air, head down as low as she can, butt up as high as she can. Somebody's going to have to take their hand and grab the cord and stick it back high up into her uterus, pushing past baby's head. Not going to be comfortable. May not be even feasible, but you're going to do the best that you can because this baby's life is on the line and someone's calling 911. She's going to be whisked away for emergency cesarean. So that's kind of like a very scary and like, whoa, holy crap, like childbirth. But cord prolapse is so, I wish I had a stat in front of me. It is so, 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 so rare. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm just saying this is one of those things.
Yeah.
Okay. There's also other reasons for cesareans, like based on state laws. So breech and twins. And one of our follower questions was about breech. They said, if my baby's breech, should I really try to press to go vaginal birth or should I just get a cesarean? And I mean, I can't make that decision for you, but some things to consider, I guess, would be it is easier to have a breech baby if it's a subsequent baby. It's not your first time baby. Mm-hmm. Breech is a variation of normal, but having a skilled, comfortable provider, it's all about the provider.
Yeah.
Having somebody who knows and is very well versed in breech is going to be your biggest benefit here, because there's ways that we can optimize a breech birth. And most of that really is just being super hands off. Typically babies are born in a hands and knees position and the mom's butt is hovering, you know, about a foot off of the bed or the table or wherever she is. And baby is allowed to come out and hang. And there's all these signs that the practitioner is looking for, like a little ab crunch and rotations and different things that the baby is doing that indicate the baby's doing well and that the head is going to be born. So with a breech, the reason where it gets kind of like tricky is body will be born and then head can get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And in this kind of hands-off all fours position, or maybe like, yeah, if you're home alone, this is good for you to know. You're home alone, your baby's coming super fast, whatever, you have nobody to help you. Get in your hands and knees, don't touch the baby, don't pull the baby out. Like allow the gravity to take place, give it, you know, after body's coming out and baby's head is up in there, give it like the biggest push you've ever had in your whole entire life and usually, and maybe rock your pelvis a little bit, baby will come out. But the skilled provider that is going to know what to look for, that where like a breech could maybe go awry because there is more risk. But here's the thing about that risk is that there are so many doctors that have graduated in the last 15 years who have never seen a breech birth because they have never been allowed to witness them because we don't even let them happen. And so they don't know, they don't have any idea how to do it. And that is really scary because it's becoming a lost art. Mm-hmm. Dr. Stuart Fishbein, and I'll write some of this down into our show notes here.
Which is crazy. And you know, not that this is all doom and gloom episode, but you know, worst case scenario, there's someone who can't get to a hospital or maybe like some, I don't know, crazy apocalyptic thing happens. And like, we don't just have C-section availability. Like we as a human society have lost the ability to birth these babies. And like, it's so silly. Like we shouldn't lose this knowledge. So anyways, I know that's a lot about breech, and to just remind people that if their baby is breech, there are things you can do. It doesn't always work, but it can. We actually just had a friend do this where the baby might turn before birth. This is like if the baby's breech, like at delivery. But if you've been diagnosed with a breech baby at like 32 weeks or whatever, like there can still be things that you can do just beside that. But it's not like you have to go down C-section route no matter what.
Yep, absolutely. So we'll put some resources for breech information in the show notes. Okay, some additional reasons. There could be like other anatomical anomalies that I'm not really touching on that would just make it really difficult for a baby to come out vaginally, maybe like some sort of a cesarean, cervical, like, you know, there had been a cervical procedure or cancer or something where there's a ton of scar tissue. It's not going to open up, or maybe she only has part of a cervix or, you know, something like that, whatever. There's reasons.
Right.
There's also reasons for elective cesareans. Like, and most of those in my realm that I'm thinking of, at least initially here, are related to trauma mitigation. So they're related to past traumas or other reasons that are similar to that, where the woman decides to elect and opt for a cesarean, or maybe there was like a very bad postpartum hemorrhage from a vaginal birth. And in order to sort of get on top of that, they decide to go this route. So there are other reasons to why someone would choose it. It's not necessarily an absolute, you must, like some of those other things. Okay, so some of the reasons that are happening today also, though, that are contributing to this high percentage is really probably number one would be this like failure to progress. And we're not going to have studies about the numbers on this because no one is going to be able to randomize control the way that a provider and a particular woman and their baby are interacting all three in this like little three best friends that anyone could ever have situation. Although I think the woman would often say that it's not, the provider is often not her best friend in these kinds of scenarios because she's put on a clock, she's given the cascade of interventions, etc. Really failure to progress can so many times be failure to wait.
Yeah.
And so it's like somebody's maybe on a very long induction and it's just like not really going well, or it's been a long time and she's, you know, getting tired, or the provider's getting over it, or, you know, maybe things are almost like completely going in the fine direction, but they're just over it. I can think of two women right now who were at 10 centimeters in the hospital and got cesareans because their providers were like, yeah, this isn't, the baby's not going to be descending. They're like not coming down. And it's like, well, but why? What do you mean? What's going on? Like, let's give us some time. Mm-hmm. This idea of laboring down, just because you reach 10 centimeters doesn't mean that the baby's ready to come out. They need to drop in station in your pelvis. The station number, which goes from positives to negatives, or negatives to positives rather, is how far the baby is descended, you know, into the pelvis and then into the vaginal canal and out. And sometimes your cervix can become 10, but the baby's actually quite high. Mm-hmm. And we just need to labor down is sort of the terminology, which just takes more time. And sometimes they don't want to do that. And, you know, maybe the water's been broken. Maybe baby's heart rate is kind of going down. We've been on Pitocin for a long time, et cetera. So that's obnoxious because some, especially in a first time labor, it just takes a while. It just takes a long time. Okay. And then another reason is baby being in distress. This is often linked to or in close association with this idea of failure to progress. Baby being in distress is often also associated with this cascade of interventions because we have to recognize the absolute truth that a Pitocin contraction is different from a brain-derived oxytocin-based contraction.
And so just for people who don't know, because I know we know, we've talked about this in other podcasts, cascade of intervention is referring to in the hospital, basically not allowing natural birth to take place or natural labor to begin. There's like one thing that they do like, oh, well, maybe let's just like give you a little Pitocin, you know, and then that turns into another intervention, which turns into another intervention. And it's a cascade that eventually unravels to a C-section because, you know, a lot of the interventions that they do in the hospital then trigger the need for other interventions. And the baby's stressed out because the Pitocin's contracting too strong or things are moving at a rate where it shouldn't be because the baby wasn't ready. And so then it causes the baby to be distressed. And so a lot of women will say, oh my God, thank God I was in the hospital because they saved my baby. And it's like, well, the baby might not needed to be saved if it wasn't in the hospital. Not always the case, but it is something that is very, very much known of this like whole cascade of intervention. So we're not saying these interventions aren't needed, like my daughter wouldn't be here without them. And a lot of times they are unnecessary or they're done in a way that is maybe not as ideal. So for anyone who didn't know what that meant, I just wanted to speak to that.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I'll put in the show notes the Business of Being Born documentary, which you've maybe heard of, maybe you haven't, maybe it's been a long time since you've seen it. It's awesome. It's by Ricky Lake. And it is
so random.
Which is so funny and random. Yeah.
So random. If you're a 90s person, like
and now she's made The Business of Birth Control. Uh-huh. And she's awesome. But anyways, it talks about this cascade of interventions well, I think. And it's tricky because nobody has a time machine. Nobody can go one direction with all these interventions, see what happens, then go back in time, don't do the interventions, see what happens, and then learn from that experience.
Right.
But we just have to know, though, some basic biological truths about humans being animals and being mammals and the way that mammals give birth and act and choose to not act shocked that when we meddle and we don't get out of the way, that things are going to become awry because birth is a hormone loop based system. And when we interrupt the hormones, the system will be interrupted. Like it makes total sense. But I think that what gets us by is that there is more women than not, because obviously then we have like a, what is it? 64% vaginal birth rate. Am I calculating that correctly?
I have no idea. Don't ask me. I can't do simple math quickly.
Either.
Wait, what's the rate of C-section?
36.
Yeah.
Yeah. 64.
Four, right? Four will be up to 40, and then 60 gets to 100. So yes, 64. That's how you got to do it.
We have flaws, you know? We can't do mental math.
We can't do. We can't be perfect at everything.
I actually, my best math class was calculus. I loved calculus so much.
I loved calculus too.
Yes. I really just like statistics, though, because of all the mental math.
Oh my gosh, me too. Or like simple accounting, or I'm like, can I use a calculator?
I just need to be able to write it down. If I can write it down, like, give me anything, throw it at me. I'm an astronomer. I'm a rocket scientist. That's not what I meant.
Astronomer.
Oh my gosh.
I'm an astrologer. Tell me your birth sign. I can do math. You're an Aries.
Oh my God, I'm sweating. I can do math. You're an Aries. Hey, this does actually take a little bit of math to figure things out.
That's true. Okay.
So anyways, this idea is that, well, there is still 64% of women that are having vaginal births. And so we kind of get away with all of these medications and different things that we do because it like works most of the time, but that number is freaking creeping up. I mean, what are we going to do? Like, when are we going to change something? Okay. Here's the other thing about this is that we know that in the United States, we have one of the worst maternal mortality rates and newborn mortality rates, morbidity of any of the first world countries. So our technology has become more advanced. We're performing more surgeries every year and our rates of actual outcome of what is happening from that are the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously there's a problem here.
Yeah.
Like what is going on? You know? So anyways, this is not the reason for this podcast, but I mean, you can tell that there's like a lot of unopened doors that need to be explored here.
Right.
And there's a lot of people out there that are trying and trying to get the word out and discuss this and da-da-da-da-da, but it's very difficult. So anyway, moving on from that, and we will put some resources into the show notes. Another one is the big baby idea, is that we need to cut your baby out because it's never going to fit through your pelvis because it's such a big baby. Oh my gosh. I could just scream. Okay, we know for a fact that an ultrasound of fetal weight is up to 2 pounds plus or minus off in guesstimation consistently across the board. Like they will take all the measurements. They'll do all the things. They'll be like, this baby, even on palpation, you can be a really good expert midwife and be totally wrong on what you're feeling because of just the way that like the water is and all of the different parts of the baby and the mom's tissue and what's happening. And it's so rare. It would not make physiological or biological sense for our bodies to create a baby that we can't birth. Like it's just very, very, very unlikely. Now, what can happen is that a totally normal sized baby may get stuck in a pelvis or have a hard time getting out of a pelvis. Not stuck like forever, like it's never coming out, but it may have a hard time getting out because it's in the wrong position.
Yeah.
And this is an additional risk factor of the cascade of interventions of things like epidurals and Pitocin, because once a woman gets on Pitocin, she's almost surely going to have to get an epidural because of the way that the contraction is so much stronger and longer and harder and all these different things. And it's just way harder to cope and manage. Birth is already hard to cope and manage with, right? So she's almost always going to get an epidural. Okay. What does the epidural do? It places us immobile. And that immobility is the biggest risk factor for birth, in my opinion, because baby is navigating the pelvis, has to do these 7 cardinal movements in order to get out. They have to rotate this way, rotate that way, get their heads lined up with the widest part of the pelvis, then get their shoulders lined up. And they have to make all these rotations. And a little 6-pound baby can absolutely have a hard time, you know, end up turning posterior, have a hard time kind of navigating out. It's not to do with the size of the baby. It's navigation and not having that ability of mom up and moving. And so we just need to be thinking about all these things. But it is very rare for you to build a baby that you can't birth out of your actual hips. Where that comes from really quick, and I really like the evidence-based birth article, and I'll put that in the show notes as well on this, because it just talks about the stats for those people that are stat-oriented. But the reason that this is even like a worry is because not that long ago in the 1800s, women were consistently not getting proper vitamin D levels and other nutrient deficiencies were happening during their developmental phase and their puberty. So their pelvises were shaped differently and they were narrow and small and weird and funky because they had rickets because they didn't have enough vitamin D. And so then, yes, those women went on to have babies and then the babies couldn't come out. But that's not happening anymore to a large extent. So anyway. Okay. So those are some of the reasons. I didn't mean to talk about that for so long.
That's okay. You're doing great. Okay. So So moving on to prep and tips if you plan a cesarean.
Yes. So this is different than if you have an unplanned cesarean because you have more time to talk with your provider about the options, prepare your mind and body and your baby, and also ask about some of the things that maybe our listeners might find interesting. So preparing your mind and your baby and your body, if you have a planned cesarean, and that might even be in a situation kind of like yours was, where you had like an hour, half an hour to kind of think about this and know that it was happening because it wasn't emergent. I think that we shouldn't underestimate the power of our, as the mother, telepathic communication with our babies and telling them what's going on.
Yeah.
Whether you want to say it out loud or you want to say it in your head, I think telling your body too, and maybe even just verbalizing it, because it can kind of be a shock. Even if it is something that's sort of planned, it can still be like, wow, okay, here we go. Like, who's mm-hmm. actually ever ready to have like a major surgery? I don't know. Nobody.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can tell your baby, hey, like, you are about to be born right now. You're going to come out and they're going to cut you out and I'm going to hold you and I can't wait to see you. And mm-hmm. it's going to be awesome and amazing. And like, this is your day. This is your moment. You're coming. And, yeah. you know, having this sort of little conversation with them, obviously one-sided, but that's okay.
I mean, I did this with my daughter and
yes, actually, will you tell us about it? Because I thought it was so sweet.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So my C-section wasn't planned in the sense that I scheduled it and was like, here it is, it's coming on this date. But it wasn't an emergency where I was like in the middle of vaginal birth and my baby's, you know, heart rate was dropping to the point where we had to do an emergency C-section to save her life in that moment. I was like in the middle of those two things where I had been in labor for over 50 hours, 52 or 56, I can't remember, in the hospital, you know, had done every intervention, but I'd labored at home, home birth planned, 32 hours at home, switched, you know, I can tell my whole birth story on another podcast. We do have it. But at the time that we decided, okay, she's not coming, we're at a time's up, we have to do this, we have to have a C-section. You know, that was like my whole world crashing down because I was like, oh my God, I didn't even prepare for this. I didn't even know what to even, you know, how to even manage or support this. But what I was clear was right away, you know, I was so looped up on probably whoever knows what they were giving me, but I felt like my daughter's still there. And as they wheeled us away, I learned this from riding horses. You know, horses, when you ride horses, they can sense your feelings. So if you're anxious and stressed, they sense that and they become anxious and stressed. You don't have to say anything to them because beings can feel each other. And we as humans feel each other and we know what's going on with people, whether you're aware of it or not. And I knew that my daughter was in the same boat. You know, she was going to feel my anxiety and feel my stress. And I did not want her to come into this world and her first experience and her birth to be that of anxiety. So I had this like crazy conversation in my head, in my intuition too, where I all of a sudden had to put my fears aside and be like, you know what? Everything that I never wanted is happening right in front of my eyes. They are literally dripping antibiotics into an IV. I'm on fentanyl. I'm on all of these things, which I didn't know at the time, which is very upsetting actually. But I had to have all of this, you know, medication that I never wanted to have, being, you know, wheeled into an emergency room with surgery preparing, nobody around me. And I said, this is happening. I'm not going to just like go into this horrible, stressed out, crazy, like, I can't believe this is happening, and the trauma and the anxiety, because I knew my daughter would feel that. And so I immediately switched the script. And I said, you know what? I couldn't birth on my own for some reason. We don't know why. But everyone in this room are like her little birth angels. And I kept telling her that over and over again. It actually makes me want to cry. And I remember I talked to her the entire time, so much so that I feel in my memory that that conversation with her is as real as if I had had it with her in face to face with me now as a toddler. Aww. I never felt weird. Like, I was just like saying it in my head. Like, I felt like I was actually talking to her. And I said over and over again, and I took deep breaths and I like calmed my anxiety. And I said, we're like in the heaven space, because I could only see up. It was very white and very bright. And I was like, this looks kind of like heaven, you know? And I was like kind of in this in-between place. And you are at the in-between of life and death, you know, when you're giving birth. And all I could see, you know, laying on my back were just like flittering movements of tons and tons of people. There were probably 20 people in my OR. And I don't know why, if that's normal, but they were just moving around so fast. And I was like, oh my gosh, these are like little birth angels. And I kept telling her that. I was like, don't be scared. Like, everything is fine. And all of these people are just helping bring you into the world. They're all your little birth angels where, you know, I'm going to meet you so soon. And I had this like really beautiful experience in the OR when I could have had a really horrible experience, being pissed off, upset, angry, all the things that could happen when something happens that you don't want, especially me. You know, I of all people don't want intervention, but I'm also smart enough to know when it's needed and that fighting it and resistance is only going to bring suffering. So if it's happening to anyone who ends up having a C-section, whether by choice or by emergency, I advise you to learn reframing before your birth. I think reframing in general is a very powerful practice. And what that means is taking the circumstance in front of you and putting it into a different perspective. And how could you move forward with your C-section and see it? Not that I think everyone should go out and get a C-section. I'm saying if this happens, how can you see it as this beautiful experience and maybe think of the doctors and the nurses as your little birth angels and that they're just here working like little fairies flittering around to like help you bring your baby into the world safely. And you just kind of have to release all the things that you want to control and have, you know, a say in because you're kind of at the mercy of what they're doing. You can obviously ask for things like delayed cord clamping and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, seeing that perspective, I think, brings a completely different energy to how your child comes into the world and how you experience your birth as either traumatic or not. So I just wanted to share that mindset shift, whatever it is, if you don't resonate with the words angels in heaven, like it could be something different, but you know, whatever yeah, it no, is.
It's because it's all you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, all you can do in that moment, feeling so powerless and just sort of subject to the whim of what's happening. And it's this like very kind of like, you're just the patient and you're, you know, getting numbed and blah, 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 blah. And all this different stuff is happening. And it's like, you know, really all you have is your breath and your ability to communicate with your baby and kind of sort of calm yourself down. The reason why I bring up the breath is because the oxygenation that your baby gets through the placenta is from you bringing in oxygen into your lungs and oxygenating your blood. So
yeah,
we need to be taking long, slow, deep breaths here so the baby can get good oxygen, especially if there's any kind of worry that maybe things aren't going well with baby's heart or, you know, usually, which would be more on the unplanned side of things. But I love that. Thank you for sharing. And I think it has such a huge impact on the way that you overall perceive your birth to be really, obviously you wanted it to be at home. There's still disappointment and there's still grief and that can come later too. And that's okay. And there's room for all of the feelings here. We don't want to say, we're not trying to like gaslight you that your experience wasn't valid or that, you know, it's okay. It's not okay to be pissed off. It's just that in this moment, mm-hmm. if you can choose to reframe for a split second and communicate, there might be some benefit there. So just consider it. Okay. Another thing is that if you are planning a cesarean, it would be really great to take some Arnica Montana, homeopathic Arnica Montana before the procedure, after the procedure, and throughout your postpartum. Really for anybody going into labor, just as soon as your labor starts, vaginal or cesarean planned, whatever, Arnica is a great one to have on hand. You can take it, you know, once at the start of it, you can take it throughout.
And this is homeopathic arnica. So I know you said that, but just for anyone, Arnica Montana, the herb, is not what you want to take.
No.
It's homeopathic arnica.
Yes, because so, Arnica Montana, the herb, is highly toxic. So
as are most homeopathic herbs, which is why they're diluted down into such a small amount that they are not toxic at all because they're just energetic at this point. But they are very helpful to the point that even, you know, surgeons who don't understand natural medicine use arnica for their patients across the board with surgery because they see the results are so much better.
Yes, so, it's very true. Especially arnica is really like the one that has been studied to any extent. It's really mm-hmm. hard to study homeopathic remedies, but we'll put this in the show notes as well. So don't worry about like writing it down or understanding what we're saying, but that could be a helpful one for that. The pain that I feel hit by a truck feeling, the run over by a car feeling, the you know, just bruising, all of the recovery that happens, especially if you're the type of if you're in the situation like you, similar mm-hmm. to you, where you've done a lot of laboring for days and days and days, and then you get the cesarean, because it's almost like a double birth in a lot of ways mm-hmm. where you've, or you know, there's people who've been pushing, even they were 10 centimeters, they were pushing for hours and then they go for cesarean, and it's like that is almost like two full births, you right. know, and so we need to be really cognizant of our postpartum bodies and helpful to their healing. So another thing though, is that if you have a planned cesarean for some reason, say it's breech, twins, whatever, and it's going to be planned ahead, well in advance, asking your provider about something called maternal assisted cesarean, or sometimes it's called gentle cesarean. And it could include things like low lights. Maybe they're playing music that you want in the OR. Maybe the drape that separates your visual field is not that blue kind of medical drape. Maybe it's a clear drape so you can watch the process of your baby coming out of your belly if you want. Or maybe they just drop the drape so that you can see like very clearly. And it's not just that they're like holding the baby up over the drape. Mm-hmm. Or maybe if if your provider would be into this and you wanted to, maternal assisted is usually refers more to that you'd be wearing these like big gloves and you could be pulling your baby out of your stomach yourself, sort of, and having that connection of pulling the baby up and out. So there are options about those sorts of things. And the more that women ask for these things, the more the demand will come into play where it can just become standard practice in a scenario where it allows. Slow and calm, you know, just not having it be this kind of classic, very sterile, cold experience. You know, there's lots of different ways. Another thing is vaginal seeding. And somebody asked about this specifically, one of the follower questions. So vaginal seeding is where they would take, usually they take like a string of cotton gauze, or sometimes it's just long. They almost look like Q-tips, long swabs, and they insert them into the vagina for a period of time, 20 minutes, let's say. And then when the baby is born, so they'd be doing this during the surgery or before, when the baby is born, then they can take the swab or the gauze and they kind of rub it all around baby's mouth and eyes and nose and all around their face and their body. And so that you're getting that vaginal inoculation of bacteria. Now, some contraindications for this could be if you were GBS positive, so you had group B strep in your vagina, it would not be appropriate there. Or if you had any kind of other infection during birth, which maybe was the reason for your cesarean as well. Like if you had some kind of a fever and you were, there was some, something else, it could be GBS or it could be otherwise, but that would be an indicator that vaginal seeding is inappropriate. They're not going to really be able to do vaginal seeding in an emergency cesarean, but again, this is something to ask about. Delayed cord clamping. So typically with delayed cord clamping, the longest that you'll get in a cesarean, a typical cesarean, is about 60 seconds. But hey, it's better than like 2 seconds.
Right.
And actually, like, a lot of the blood can drain out of the cord within a 1 minute period.
Right.
Doing something like skin to skin right away, which sometimes women can't hold their babies very well because their arms are very shaky and weak. Sometimes they're, you know, just don't feel like comfortable with it. But if there is an ability to do skin to skin with you or with your partner, like Mike did in the OR, stripped down, no shirt in the OR, but he still had his little hat thing on. He had AV skin to skin. It was beautiful. That's a really nice thing that can happen unless there's something going on with the baby where they need to be monitoring. Your modified golden hour for a cesarean would just be as soon as you guys can come back together, having that skin to skin and, you know, baby's hat is off of baby, you're smelling the top of your head. There's blankets on top of you, so the temperature regulation is not an issue. You're allowing them to lick around and maybe even have a first latch. Ideally, we have that first latch as soon as after birth as we can, but sometimes babies are just like not into it as well, and that's okay. Just as soon as they feel comfortable with that. But so these are some things that can absolutely happen if there's no indication not to.
Right. And just a quick tip, if you do have a C-section, typically the meds that they give you for the anesthesia will make you really shaky and feel really, really weird. So if you're trying to breastfeed your child after, just know that that is normal and typical and that like it will pass, because I know for me, it felt very stressful all of a sudden when I was handed a baby after this major procedure and I could hardly even hold her to breastfeed because I was shaking so hard. And that is just because of the medication and also the shock of being in surgery. And so, you know, just be prepared for that going into your first latch. If it doesn't happen, great. But if it does, because I think some women might feel robbed of that first feeding moment, you know, in a way I kind of did, of like, wow, this is not beautiful at all how I imagined it. It's like, I'm like freaking out and I like need someone to help me hold my baby. Like I can't even hold them. So if you're prepared.
Or that people just don't even know that that's a possibility. So that is actually kind of pretty common.
So just know that going into it, that if you choose to have a C-section or it's an emergency, you know, just get your mindset and prepare for that first feed potentially not being what you like imagine or see, you know, in movies or whatever.
Yes. And you'll get there. You'll get to the point where you
absolutely, and it's still beautiful. Like, you know, especially for me, my first feed, even with all of that, it was still like so amazing. I was like, oh my God, my baby. But like, I did was like, what is happening to me? I feel like a psycho. I'm like, just like shaking all over the place.
Yeah. And like, you know, with walking and stuff too, if you're not feeling comfortable and set in it, you need to ask for some help because the shakes are something that can happen for a period of time. Okay. So some prep and tips, if it's an unplanned cesarean, many fewer things, because this would just be in a really quick kind of setting. But again, staying calm and deep breaths as much as you can, having a quick little mental note talk with your baby as you're getting wheeled in. Arnica, if possible, you know, again, maybe even you just took it in the beginning of your labor, but if not before, then certainly after. Mm-hmm. And you may need to stay more on top of pain management, because a quicker cesarean is probably going to be a little bit rougher, a little bit, done faster than something that's very, very calm and chill where they can take all the time in the world. I mean, these surgeons are amazing. They can get a baby out like in 3 minutes and they're cutting through 7 layers of tissue, and they have a lot of work that they have to do in order to do a cesarean. But in those emergency situations, we can get babies out very quick, and that's awesome. And mother may experience, some more pain and bruising from that. Mm-hmm. And then some more homeopathics to consider for some of the emotionality of the experience could be aconite, or it's sometimes called aconitum napellus. And that is a great one for shock and kind of feeling sort of like, what in the world just happened? Mm-hmm. Maybe feeling really fearful. Something came on really quickly. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like the main shock remedy. And then sort of likened to that in the grief world is Ignatia. Mm-hmm. So there might be lots of feelings that can come up about grief, or that revolve around grief immediately, or they may take several months or even years to come on. But I would say that that is a common thing where people process their birth after a period of time, and then they have these feelings come up. And homeopathics can be very helpful for moving feelings through us completely. They're not suppressors.
Right.
They're not something that's going to just make it go away like a Band-Aid and then it's going to just come right back necessarily. It's almost like it truly helps you chip away at the huge boulder of whatever it is, the feeling or the pain or the symptom of whatever the symptom is. It truly helps it process through you in a different kind of a way, so that it's fully integrated into your system and your body.
Yeah. They're amazing. Love homeopathy.
Okay. Pain management in general. So one thing that is to just know, two things to know. First of all, the way that women respond to their pain meds is, and the way that they respond to the the severity of the pain is wildly variable. Like, it can really, really, some women are like, oh, I took, just the ibuprofen after the cesarean and I was totally fine. And some women are like, no, I needed the narcotics for like 5 to 6 days afterwards. And so just know, it doesn't really have to do with your pain tolerance. It's just kind of this varied experience. Some people respond better or worse or whatever. But one thing, as best as you can, is to stay on top of your pain. So trying to taper too quickly is problematic. Can you tell people why that is?
Yeah. Well, I did this and that was not ideal. But basically, with pain, your body can't heal in pain. And especially with pain and inflammation in general, like, you don't ever want it to get out of hand, because it's really hard to put out a raging fire than to just keep, embers at bay. So with pain, you, like I said, your body can't heal if it's in pain. So you need to just keep on top of it. Don't let your medication lag, and be very, very mindful about cutting out too soon. Like, I stopped the liquid or the IV pain meds in the hospital too soon, because I just wanted to go home. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night being like, oh my God, I made a huge mistake. This is really, really bad. I'm just now feeling the thing that these medications were suppressing. And the only thing they could give me was like oral Tylenol. And it was really, really, really horrible. And then it makes it that much harder to do anything, to be with your baby. And it's a lot harder to then stop the pain pathways. Like, pain is very interesting in general, and just the way that it correlates with your, like, there's pain peptides, and then there's, nervous system things happening, with the pain. And so, yeah, you just don't want to cut it out too soon. Everyone is different, but just being whatever they say, however long to take it, like, don't wait longer and be like, oh, I'm going to try to get off of this as soon as possible. Yes, you don't want to be on pain meds forever, but especially in that first week, do what they say, whatever your doctor says of however often to take it, because it's really hard to get back on top of it once you've let the pain,
come back. Come back. And like, obviously we are really pro using all sorts of natural things. Yep. And you just had a really, really, really big thing happen to your body.
It's a huge surgery.
And it's okay. Like, it's okay for a week to be on some meds. Like, you know, you might have some negative side effects from them, like constipation or what, and we'll talk about that. But like you were just saying, being in pain in new motherhood is just, nobody wants that for anybody.
Yeah. You don't get a golden medal for being the person who didn't take the pain meds. You just don't. So your postpartum experience is going to be better if you can have and enjoy like the first few days with your child. And, you know, obviously for me, like I don't even take ibuprofen, like, in, you know, I take extreme measures to not take medications. And there is a time and a place. And the time and the place for them is when you have had a major abdominal surgery and you are a postpartum mother who is not sleeping. And it has been through like a huge thing. So it's okay. I give you permission. If you're someone who needs permission, I give you permission to take the support and help yourself out. It's obviously not going to be for the rest of your life. And if you find yourself feeling like you need pain meds, you know, for weeks and weeks beyond, there's something clearly wrong.
Something's wrong. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, I am thinking of a couple of people who told me that they only really needed like 1 or 2 days of the hardcore meds and then they dropped down to something, like Tylenol or ibuprofen. And for them, it was okay. And so this is what we're talking about with the individuality. But like, if you are somebody who is needing it, just do it. Because if you try to, it's like, I just want to reiterate this one more time. I know we already said it, but if you try to dip below and not take as much medication and see, well, what's my pain like? Mm-hmm. You're playing with fire, because it sometimes is very, very hard then to get back on top of taking more meds and making that sensation of that pain sensation go back away. Yeah. It was managed at a certain level and it may not be anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the weird pain dynamics that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So other symptom management of things that can come from that, like from the narcotics, it's very common to become constipated because of the way that narcotics slow your whole system down. Mm-hmm. And they will probably offer you something like Docus, how do you pronounce that?
I know what you're talking about. That.
I can't say it, but it's a stool softener. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to take the stool softener, yeah, I get it. You can take something like magnesium citrate would be the one that's the osmotic laxative. My personal favorite product, I don't know, I'd love to hear about yours, would be Triple Mag by Vital Nutrients. Again, we'll write this down. And it has three different types of magnesium in it. None of them are citrate, actually. So it's malate, glycinate, and oxide. And I know oxide isn't like the greatest, but it does pull oxygen into the colon. The malate and the glycinate can be sort of for other functions in the body as well. And it totally does help with constipation. You may have to increase your dosing, but staying on top of that with something is important, because you do not want to become hard and constipated when you have, and then have to strain to push a bowel movement out when you have this incision in your belly. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to be many days without stooling, because one of our main detox pathways, et cetera. There's lots of reasons. You want to really, really have a plan. Either take the stool softener or take lots of magnesium. Don't have like a day or two where you're trying to figure it out. Like, you have to take something.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's your favorite magnesium for?
I really like Calm, which is Calm just nice citrate. And the citrate brings water in. And so you need to drink a lot of water with it. So I like it because it's a powder and it tastes really good. And you naturally have to drink a glass of water with it. And so you're like getting both, you know, together. And then, yeah, I think that can work really, really well for people. But also, you know, getting on top of that, making sure that you're doing as much as you can with making sure that you have a bowel movement. You know, you can't obviously even massage your belly or anything because you just had a major surgery, and it's not going to be perfect in any way. But yeah,
you'll make it work. Mm-hmm. And then for swelling, so there's some other homeopathics that we can write down in the show notes too that could be helpful. There's compression socks, there's compression kind of airbag things that they might be able to give you in the hospital too if your legs are really swollen. There's massage with like a little grapefruit essential oil. Some people do end up becoming actually quite bloated, and that's fairly uncomfortable. Swollen. And then there's also bloating. Bloating mm-hmm. can be a common thing from this as well. And something like homeopathic carbo veg may be helpful for it. homeopathic Bellus is great also for the aches and the pains. So I'll write a little list down that can be helpful for you guys. But just know that there will be some symptoms that can kind of pop up, and there's things we can do to manage them. Okay, something that I think is also really important to talk about is the breastfeeding nuances that can be different because of because of the cesarean. And this isn't going to be everybody's experience, but just know and expect it. If it doesn't happen to you, great. If it does, you're prepared. So first of all, your milk might be a little bit delayed in coming in. So you already have milk in your breast. It's called colostrum. But as it transitions into the white milk in that typical 3 to 5 day period, it might be closer to that 5 day period for you. And this can be stressful to women because they're feeling like their baby is, you know, dropping too much weight or maybe not gaining quite yet or whatever is happening. But just know that that can be something because of the hormone loops that have been kind of disrupted and are getting back into play.
Mm-hmm.
It can take a couple extra days. That doesn't mean that you're never going to get it in. So you need to keep feeding your baby and keep that stimulation going that whole time. But just look out for that. Also, you may be more engorged. So when your milk does transition from colostrum to white typical milk, most women do experience a day or two or sometimes more of hard, firm breasts mm-hmm. that are filled. It's not actually filled with milk. It's not that your breast is like just completely filled. Mm-hmm. It's actually a lot of swelling in the lymphatics, in the interstitial fluid, which is between the cells. And, it's just this kind of like big fluid swollen party that happens as the milk is transitioning. Because you've had all these IV fluids in relation to the cesarean, you will have been kind of pumped more full with fluids. And so your engorgement may be worse.
Mm-hmm.
People might be like, well, why does it matter if engorgement is worse? It matters because it can flatten out your nipple. Because imagine your breast becoming kind of like a hardened rock. And so now this like tissue laxity and give for the baby to latch onto your nipple is very firm behind there. And it's like, they can't pull it away from they can't really get much of your areola in their mouth. And so you might have to do something called reverse pressure softening. I'll put a YouTube video in the links in the show notes, but basically you're going to take two fingers and you're going to both of your hands, two fingers on the right and the left side, hand side of your nipple on your areola. You're just going to press directly straight into your chest wall with like a medium pressure for 30 seconds. Then you're going to go to the other like four corners, if you're almost making a square around your nipple,
mm-hmm.
to the top and the bottom of your nipple, and you're going to do the same thing. And you're going to do that enough so that there's a little bit of give around your immediate nipple, and then you're going to immediately latch your baby. Mm. And you may have to do this for a couple of days every time you're going to latch so the baby can get a really good, nice deep one. A deep latch is important for multiple things, not just your tissue damage, you know, to not damage you, but so that they can get that peak place of where they press onto the nipple to get as most of the milk out as possible.
Mm.
Okay, so that's something. Also, baby's weight, their birth weight can be skewed for the same reasons of the engorgement from the fluids. Their weight can be a couple of ounces higher. So say it says that the baby is 7.5 pounds, well, or 7 pounds, 8 ounces. Baby might actually be 7 pounds, 4 ounces. So there's sort of 3 or 4 ounces of wiggle room here that the reason why this matters is that there is a physiological weight loss that happens to most babies, that they're able to lose up to 10% of their birth weight mm-hmm. over the course of that first week, where nobody's freaking out. It's like, it's common. It's like, okay, yeah, whatever. And then baby should start to regain, and then they should regain birth weight at least by 3 weeks. They should be at regained birth weight, if not beyond.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of babies are beyond at that point, but this is sort of the variable window. And so it can seem like a C-section baby has more weight loss because there's just these ounces that were skewing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, from the IV fluids. Yep.
Yes. From the IV fluids. So we just need to take that into account. So there's like three things that can kind of be up against you with breastfeeding. And I'm not saying this to say that you can't be successful, because I do think you absolutely can. You are incredibly successful. Lots of people are, but it's helpful to know so that we're like, okay, I'm not freaking out. My milk's not in yet. It's coming in. Okay. I'm engorged now. I know what to do about it. Oh, okay. My baby seems to have lost more weight than what would be typical. I'm still not going to freak out because mm-hmm. I know I can get, you know, through this and by this. And working with a lactation consultant is going to be your best thing that you can do to mm-hmm. keep all of these little moving parts and tabs. In addition to that, you may need to look into some different breastfeeding positions. You know, the one that where we really see most people, which is like cross cradle across the arms. that might not work for you because it might put too much pressure on your incision.
Yeah.
So something like football hold or side lying or even laying back. Although if you have a very long baby and a short torso, if you're laying on your back and they're kind of laying on top of you, their little feet might be right at the height mm-hmm. to kick your incision. So you'll have to just kind of play around with what feels comfortable to you. What
I loved football when she was really little.
Mm-hmm. Football. Okay.
Yeah. It was just because she was a bigger baby. And so I would just tuck her, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, you can look it up, but on both sides. And that was a really good go-to for us for a while. Mm-hmm.
Good. I remember her coming out with the most fantastic newborn latch I think I've ever seen in my life. I was like, wow, look at that.
Those big lips like your daddy.
It's beautiful. Okay. So some other things to think about, this is a little bit further down the road in postpartum recovery from a cesarean, is scar remediation and pelvic floor physical therapy. So even though you've had a cesarean, pelvic floor physical therapy is still very indicated for you, if not more, because you still carry the weight of a baby on your pelvic floor for 9 or 10 months. And that stresses things and does things. You may also have had points in your labor. Well, you did have dilation, or maybe you didn't, but if you did, or especially if you were like pushing at some point before the cesarean, all of that is involving this entire thing. But also now you've had your abdominal wall cut, and as things reheal and the pressures are equalizing again and you're learning your strength and how to breathe and how to use all your muscles, it can be very, 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 very beneficial to have a pelvic floor physical therapist as part of your team. Mm-hmm. They can also teach you how to do the scar remediation mm-hmm. properly. What I mean by scar remediation is that your incision line will heal, and then it will go through these various stages of maybe being numb for a while. Mm-hmm. Or feeling odd, like weird nerve stuff, while your nerves are regenerating. And there's ways that we can help this process along. So somebody did write in, there's a follower question about, I think she said the couple of inches right above the scar are still like totally numb. And baby's like 5 months old.
Yeah.
So we can begin to bring back sensation by doing desensitization work. So sometimes it's really sensitive and sometimes it's numb. It just like kind of depends.
Mm-hmm.
So first you kind of work around the scar doing, you know, maybe with a cotton ball or a Q-tip, and then you're doing these kind of motions. You can look this stuff up on YouTube as well. And then after a period of time, you're going directly on the scar. This is the desensitization portion of the scar remediation. Then after you've done those two steps, the next phase is to go into the mobilization around the scar. So you're mobilizing the skin and the tissue and all of the multiple layers around the scar. So you're kind of pinching up just your skin. Then you're pinching just your skin and your fat. Mm-hmm. Then you're trying to get more and more and deeper and deeper. Then after you've been cleared and probably under the guidance of a pelvic floor PT, you're going to be doing the mobilization of the actual scar itself.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to be very well and healed, you know, 4 or 6 weeks postpartum at least. And somebody also wrote in about a keloid scar. And for keloids, that is probably just the way that you are going to have healed. But you, some of this remediation, though, can mm-hmm. help break down that scarring as well. And slowly, it's going to be a very slow process, but your body can resorb some of that thickened scar line of the keloid.
Yeah,
it's not like a guarantee, but it's worth a shot for sure. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I would just say once, like, learn if you've had a C-section, reach out to a pelvic PT right away to learn what is the proper timing of everything, not only with like walking and starting to move and exercise, which maybe you'll get into this, but you don't want to do abdominal things too soon. You really don't. It can cause all sorts of issues with your musculature, and you know, you can get more of a separation like the diastasis recti. It can cause issues with your scar healing. You obviously don't want to not move at all, but there's a very proper way to do it as far as timing and how with that healing process in the whole abdominal region. And it's important to do it correctly if you can, because, you know, your abdominals are important. This is a key yeah. part of your life. With healing the scar itself, exactly the same thing of finding out the best timing from a pelvic PT, or, you know, learning as well in like the resources that we provided in other places. But don't, once you're in the window where you can start working on your scar, really, really do it, really prioritize it. I wish that I had done it even sooner for myself. And one of the things I found was really great is using vitamin E oil. So I would take vitamin E oil and rub it all over the scar once I was able to do the mobilization. And then what this is, if you're trying to do mobilization, you don't want to have oil because you can't grab the skin. But once you've done that, take the vitamin E oil and then get a gua sha stone. And my pelvic PT actually taught me how to do this. Lauren, she's great. And you basically like rub out the scar and it hurts. Like this is the one thing about doing the scar work is it does hurt and it's not very comfortable and you can be really like sore the next day or the day after. So, you know, you don't want to go crazy. It's more consistency. A little bit consistently is key versus going crazy on your scar, you know, at one time. But I saw some really, really good results from the vitamin E oil. And then I think that you had mentioned, you know, you can work on some of the scar tissue. Red light therapy can be really helpful for scar tissue.
Ooh, yeah.
If you have access to a red light, you know, doing any sort of red light around your scar and just while your C-section is healing in general. I would say, though, to be really cautious of pushing yourself too hard too soon post C-section. I do know some moms, it's like 2 weeks later, they're like up walking around and doing all sorts of things and lifting the baby. And it's like, it's not that you can't do it, but just be really, really mindful because you went through a major abdominal surgery. Just imagine your partner just had his entire abdomen cut open. Like, would you be having him pick up big sand bags and throw them around and, you know, be up on your feet? Like, would he be up on his feet? No, you'd probably be like, sit down. Like, you just had major abdominal surgery. There's something that happens with women that we like don't seem to count as people that can rest or something. And it's like you need to really rest so that it heals properly, because then you might be dealing at later times with prolapse or issues with, you know, your abdominal muscle issues. So you just don't want that.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, later on, once everything is very, very set and settled and healed, you can do things like castor oil packs and mm-hmm. craniosacral therapy to help with the fascia that's underneath. All the while, and you can start these ones immediately postpartum, is like increasing your vitamin C, collagen, gelatin type intake, or just something like bone broth will cover a lot of that, those bases, adequate protein. So these are all tissue healing, modalities to be mindful of so mm-hmm. that you can be the best new version of yourself that you can be, you know, mm-hmm. the balance between rest and movement is huge because it is good to get up and walk around a little bit, but you don't want to be like going on a mile long walk in your neighborhood at 5 days postpartum every day. Like, just don't do that. Like, get up and walk around your house and call it and be proud that you did that because mm-hmm. your whole core strength of your body was cut. So, some other little tips that can be helpful is, you know, looking into getting a zip hoodie or a button shirt, the clasp bras, things that you don't have to put over your head.
Yeah.
So you don't have to lift your arms up over your head. Cause that can be really tricky and painful for a little while. So those are just tiny little things, but okay. And then we have some other kind of random questions from the followers that we're going to go over. So
here, why don't I'll ask them and then you answer.
Okay.
So thoughts on going past 42 weeks for a VBAC versus induction or scheduled repeat cesarean?
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, depending on where you live, you're not going to be able to go, unfortunately, past 42 weeks. But if you can wait up until that and see if spontaneous labor happens, that is the best, because spontaneously in a spontaneous labor setting, 75% of women who attempt a VBAC are successful. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority. In a attempting VBAC setting where there's an induction, 60% of women are successful. So 15% less success rate with an induction. And that's again, because now we're meddling with the way the body's, everything's going with the body. And so if we don't have to induce, it would be better to not. So I would say kind of do a middle ground between those two things, wait up until the very last second. And then if you have to choose an induction, then you do. ACOG is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. They say that if you have a low-lying transverse incision, so that's just like a typical incision, you didn't have to have some kind of higher or maybe like a vertical incision. They used to do that a lot more often. They don't anymore, but they do sometimes in other countries. Anyways, then you may be induced with a Foley bulb, which is the little bulb catheter that they fill up with water, inserted it into your cervix and they blow it up and then it puts pressure on the cervix so that it can dilate it. You can be induced with Pitocin or with artificial rupture of membranes. That means breaking of your water. Mm-hmm. I would say of those, start in that order, go Foley bulb first, then Pitocin, then breaking of water. depending on the scenario, but that would be like my choice for most women. You're not able to be induced though with misoprostol, which is Cytotec. So that's the only contraindication. Cytotec is kind of bad news in a lot of different ways, but specifically if you are had a past cesarean. So
what about, are antibiotics necessary for all cesareans?
I think that this is a time and place where we don't want to mess around with not taking antibiotics.
I agree. There's a time and a place. Taking an antibiotic for a viral cold is not the time. Getting a major abdominal surgery is the time. So I would say yes, but then replenish with good antibiotic support, lots of fermented food, things like that.
Yeah. And there's a Clear Labs product that's called ABX support. It stands for antibiotic support. It's specifically, you know, a good one to take directly after something like a round of antibiotics, especially IV antibiotics. And then you can go to like a general broad spectrum probiotic after that as well.
Cool. What fetal heart rate do you consider necessary for a cesarean? That's kind of a specific question for like an OB-GYN.
Yeah. And I honestly don't know. I feel like I didn't even write an answer in the outline here because I feel like it's really dependent upon so many different things.
That's a very big situational thing. I don't think there's a hard number you can answer that with.
Yeah. Like, is the heart rate tanking during the peak of a contraction and you're pushing and, you know, that and this and that and that, or is it like the whole time? Or it's too nuanced.
Based on a situational situation. Yeah. So what about your perspective on the spiritual, emotional components for healing and repair for mom and baby?
Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of resources in this set of show notes. I'm going to just paste them all. And there is a lot that can be done here. So there are people who specialize in birth trauma. There's EMDR or finding a therapist that can help walk you through it in whatever way is probably would be best for you to go through the trauma. But just know that you're not alone. There is a lot out there. There's a lot of people who feel similarly. There are support groups. There's things like Postpartum Support International. There's patch.org, there's ICANN. You know, you can join these organizations that have local chapters maybe near you where you can meet with other women and be talking about it. Then there's things like the home birth cesarean book, home birth cesarean, meaning like somebody was planning a home birth, like you planning a home birth and then it ended in cesarean. And that's a particular situation because it's going from one end of the extreme to the next. And they also now have a workbook, companion workbook that goes along with that. That's called Healing from a Home Birth Cesarean. So you can get those two together if you're the kind of person that likes to journal. Body workers who are trauma informed can also be really amazing, like energy healer type workers. They can work with you and your baby. And then you can do rebirthing exercises as well. So rebirthing is like a whole thing topic. There's lots of different ways to do it, but even something as simple as getting in the bathtub with your baby once you're cleared for something like bathing and having like a skin to skin moment with maybe there's a little ceremony to it and maybe, you know, you're nursing in the water and you're being intentional. It's an intentional practice where you're trying to kind of rewrite the way that their birth went, and they may have their own expression of it that can come up later and yours may come and go in waves and like the grief roller coaster, you know, it might not even come up for several months. You might think, oh, it's totally fine. And then you're 4 or 5 months postpartum going, what in the world was that? What happened? Why did that happen? And you're having all these questions and you might go through the whole anger and denial and all the different things. So, check out all these resources in the show notes here because I think that they could be really helpful for you.
Okay. And then we already talked about restoring sensation. So the last question, restoring good bacteria, you kind of spoke on that about that a little bit as well.
Yeah. So the vaginal seeding can be really helpful for the baby. So this was in relation to the baby specifically, is how to get the baby good bacteria when they weren't able to go through the canal. If for some reason you couldn't do the seeding, you didn't do the seeding, or you want something in addition to that, there is a probiotic brand now called Avivo that is really specifically awesome for babies. They're for lots of different reasons, but one of them is a specific indication for cesarean born babies. And you mix it, it's like these little packet satchels, you mix it with milk and give it to them in this like little syringe. And the system's really cool. I'm a big fan. Everything that I've learned about Avivo, I think is pretty cool. So that would be another one that we'll link in the show notes for you. And thank you guys all for writing in all your questions. And thank you, Dr. Leah, for giving us your perspective because, you know, having had one, it's obviously much more close to home and it's important to hear how it was for you. And we hope that this is helpful for any woman that is either going through it or maybe is, you know, listening to this after the fact, whatever it is. It's always a good idea to be prepped as well and to know how to support your friends. So thank you all. And we will hear from you and talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.